of the Voyager recording, which we're going to play you in four parts before each of the final four programs in series, since there were five, but obviously started this with the second one, then about a third one. The Voyager recording, for those of you who are not familiar with it, and I know we have a number of people who were here tonight that were not here last time because of the snow, is a recording, literally a phonograph record. It is like the ones that you play on your turntable at home, except that it's 16 2/3 RPM instead of the normal 33 1/3, and it is made of metal, gold-plated copper to be precise, rather than the usual polyvinyl chloride. It is a recording which has been placed on each of the two Voyager spacecraft, which are currently on the way towards Jupiter and Saturn, and in one case possibly Uranus, both of which will leave the solar system and fly forever, literally forever, into interstellar space after they finish their planetary missions. The arrival of the two Voyager spacecraft at the first of their targets, which is Saturn, is next year, respectively in the spring and the summer. The theory is that in the exceedingly unlikely but not utterly unprovable event that some extraterrestrial culture should find these very tiny spacecraft in the immensity of interstellar space after a lapse of almost certainly millions to billions of years, that the human race has signed them in a sense, the way the medieval artists have signed churches that they built, with a two-hour recording of ourselves and our planet rotating from what we're about. There are pictures on the recording as well in audio analog form. Those you have not heard, you can't hear them, you see them, and replacing the audio analog would be a series of beeps and boops and would drive you crazy. I do not have a set of pictures, or else, maybe I would show them to you twice. But the part that you just heard was the non-musical portion. There are 10 minutes of the record at the beginning, which are devoted to the pictures. Then you have the 20-minute non-musical portion, beginning with, a very slight musical introduction, which is a portion of the cavatina from Beethoven's 13th string quartet, which ends the record 2 hours later, over on the other side. Then Secretary General Waldheim's introduction, very brief statements, most of which are quite trivial in nature, all how are you, that sort of thing, in 55 Earth languages, starting with ancient Sumerian, which is the oldest record that is the oldest language of which we have any notion of how it was pronounced, and ending with modern English, with the child reading that you heard. Then a sound essay, as originator Andrewian called it, of natural sounds, simple human sounds, and then more and more sophisticated human sounds, culminating in the launch of Saturn V, and then as a sort of coda, an indication that life goes on the Earth and is a part of the universe. Those sounds were probably the most difficult to recognize at the end. The Saturn V was followed by a kiss, believe it or not, and then a very short sound, you don't notice it unless you're listening for it, the cry of a baby, and then an electroencephalogram and an electrocardiogram, both rendered in audio terms. And then that final sound, that with a full star. And that's the end. Now the remainder of the music, the remainder of the recording, 90 minutes, which we will play at the beginning of, before the beginning of each of the next three programs, is devoted entirely to music, and it's a survey of the music of planet Earth. Only 40% of it is Western classical music, 10% is American popular music in one variety or another, or I should say Western popular music in one variety or another, which means that even half of it is music that you are not likely to have encountered before unless you happen to be an ethnomusicologist. And it is a really, I think, fascinating survey, finest introduction you could imagine to the music of your own particular planet. And of course, one of the impressions that people have when they listen to it is how little they know about the richness, the diversity of cultures on just this one tiny little world that we think of as our own, we think of as the one that we know. Those segments will start promptly at 7 p.m. before each of the next three lectures. And the reason for doing this is each one is half an hour, and we would like from now on to get started exactly at 7:30 with the lecture because we have a limited time for them. So we sort of fly and come early a little bit by getting the Voyager recorded in pieces. I'm not going to talk about Project Voyager in this particular series, although it is part of Space 1979. There are so many things happening this year, there simply wasn't room for everything. We had five lectures, and we wanted to do a good job of what we could fit in rather than trying to do a smorgasbord presentation and not give all the events they're due. However, if you would like to know about Voyager, I'm also giving a lecture series, which is called Jim Loudon on Space, at Michigan State University up at East Lansing. And given that I-96 exists and that we are not expecting another blizzard between now and tomorrow, which is when the next lecture is, it's entirely possible that some of you can make it up there. It's not there as a large drive from Detroit to East Lansing anymore. The series of lectures is about a number of different things, but it happens that the next two, tomorrow and then 1 month from tomorrow, tomorrow's February 9th, the other one's March 9th, are two lectures which are free, they're open to the public, everybody's invited, most definitely including you, and they are intended as an introduction to Project Voyager. Tomorrow's lecture is called Jupiter, and it's a summary of what we know about the planet Jupiter, leading up to what Voyager is going to discover. Probably won't talk much about Voyager itself tomorrow. The second lecture, a month later, March 9th, is called Beyond Jupiter, and I will talk about Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, and Chiron, which is the object which Charles Cole discovered last year, widely and incorrectly described as a new planet. It's not, it's more interesting than that, and stranger than that. It's a completely different kind of object, one that we did not know existed at all. I'll talk about that, and I will talk about the Voyager mission itself. The information about that and about other lectures that I'm giving elsewhere in southeastern Michigan and about astronomical events for the public, which I'm not doing, at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. All that information is on a free mimeograph handout. There are copies of it which will be available in the back. We're going to put them out right now. You are most encouraged to take a copy. If you have a friend who might be interested, a relative, a child, anybody, please take several. If you have friends in other cities, for example, gee, you don't want to go to East Lansing, but you got a friend up there who'd be just thrilled if they knew about it, please take a copy and send it to them. They're free and they're going to be up there in the back. Okay. Today's lecture is a follow-on to last week, but for those of you who were not here last week, fear not, it is independently understandable, I think. Last week's built up to it. The first flight into orbit of the space shuttle are going to be happening in 1979, and so of course it was something we wanted to talk about. So last week's lecture was about the shuttle. This lecture today is the only one in the series that is about something that is not going to happen in 1979. But it seemed logical to put it in, first because it is an extremely important subject, second because it is something that can follow on from the shuttle, which is a 1979 event. Space colonization does not have to happen, even though we have a shuttle, but space colonization could not happen if we did not have a shuttle. So, for that reason, it's a follow-on from last week. Before we talk about space colonization, however, I do have a brief film, about 5 minutes, which I promised you last time, of the first test. Pre-flight of the approach and landing test series of the Space Shuttle Orbiter Enterprise, and we're going to start off with that now. Without further ado, here is that film from Johnson Space Center in Houston. One of the questions in the Q&A period last time was, why do the chase planes fly so close? Is it just so they can get good close-up pictures? I think you've seen the answer to that question. It is indeed so they can get good close-up pictures. A couple of other announcements, by the way, for those of you who are into such things. No, go ahead, you can turn the lights down. I'm just talking. They can't see the slides, not me. Hear me, maybe. I will give a lecture in Ann Arbor, first of a series of three, this coming Friday, the day after tomorrow, one of a series of updates on the Viking Mars exploration. And those of you who were here last year, particularly for the series of Viking lectures that I gave, might be interested in those. Almost all of the material tomorrow will be material that has come in since that lecture series. There'll be a little bit of overlap, but not a whole lot. And I'm sorry, tomorrow, day after tomorrow. One day after tomorrow, there's one a week after that, and there's one a week after that. And also about space colonization, for those of you who are going to be up in the
ghastly hour of 7:15 in the morning this coming Sunday, you can reward yourself, if that's the word, by turning on WABX, which is a rock station in Detroit. And I always tell, when I make this announcement, I've made it to several audiences in the last week or so, I always tell instantly who the rock fans are, because a minority of the faces light up and say, oh yeah, right, and everybody else goes, who? Okay, they're going to go off rock for an hour, and they're going to have a program, an interview program, which is an interview of me about space colonization, and conceivably I'll say some things there that I won't say here, or if you got friends that you think ought to be educated after you've heard tonight's lecture, there's a good opportunity. So, okay, could we have the room lights up, please? The space colonization concept can be described very simply, and so I'm going to give it to you in about a paragraph and spend the rest of the lecture filling in the details. And this is a nice slide to have in the background while I do that. In fact, it's already an obsolete design, this notion, this concept is evolving so rapidly, but it's a beautiful picture, and I'll tell you why it's obsolete, and it does tend to illustrate the idea. We have the capability, with essentially present-day technology, by which I really mean present-day plus 5 years or so, as soon as the space shuttle gets really going, to build, if we wish, artificial worlds in space, miles in size, even the first one, such as this one, this was an early design for a prototype colony, capable of housing tens of thousands of people, and very quickly escalating along about the second, third, along about the third, fourth, fifth colony built, to the point where they're housing millions of people, all of them in conditions which are not like living in a submarine, it's not like the sort of thing that you've seen in space, the pictures of the inside of Skylab, which, let's face it, was a nice place to visit, but you wouldn't want to live there. This is a case, we have the capability of living in conditions that are as pleasant materially and as beautiful aesthetically as the most favored locations on the Earth. You could duplicate some of the most favored locations on Earth, elements of them. It would not look like entirely an Earth-like environment, but it would be no terribly different from an Earth-like place that you might be used to than one of those is from another. For example, the Eskimos versus the Sahara nomads, both of whom live in places that look quite different from one another, and yet each of whom loves it and calls it home. We will be able to do this economically, without robbing anybody, without cheating anybody, without hurting or polluting anything. We will be able to do it using materials and energy available in space, and even the first one, this prototype colony, would be built with about 99% of its total tonnage made from materials coming from somewhere else than the Earth. Low-gravity environments, which are easier to get to and get away from than the Earth, and in fact, that is the key to the whole idea. So it would not involve plundering the Earth. The energy is sunlight, which is much more available, much more usable in space than it is on this planet. We could do it for an amount of money which would be considerably smaller than we would spend on cosmetics during the same time period, and we would get all that money back relatively rapidly, within a few decades after the project started. If we do this, it will enable us to solve many of the problems which we are worried about on Earth today. You start off, this is a sort of kindergarten exercise, by eliminating the energy crisis with a totally free, totally non-polluting, literally inexhaustible on any human time scale source of energy, namely sunlight, raw sunlight gathered in space by huge solar energy collectors, tens of miles in size, manufactured by the people in space colonies, and then towed down from material that is also from space, from the moon or from asteroids, over in the environment, and then towed down into orbit above the Earth. And it turns out it's a good deal cheaper to do it that way than to build them on the Earth and spend all of the fuel and energy and therefore money that is needed to lift them through the heavy gravitational field of our planet. With a few hundred of these, we could supply the world's energy needs. And we could do it in a way that would be non-polluting, that would not require any sort of plundering of the finite resources of the Earth. Later on, it appears that the technique will be able to solve or to greatly alleviate quite a number of the other problems that plague us, overpopulation in a limited way at the very end, say within a century or so from now, and before that, things like hunger, mainly because of the cheap energy. The cost of agriculture is for a developing country is primarily the cost of the energy that is needed to do things like make fertilizer, and things like resource depletion, pollution, and so forth. Again, because if you have really cheap energy, there is no such thing as resource depletion, and there is no such thing as pollution. After all, the atoms are still on the same planet. There's no such thing as pollution. There are merely atoms that happen to be arranged chemically in ways that you don't happen to like, and unfortunately, in ways that the energy cost of getting them rearranged into ways that you do like is prohibitive with current energy sources. So it seems like a really wonderful contribution of space technology to mankind, and it is something, it sounds so incredible, you know, it sounds like something that ought to be out of Buck Rogers in the 25th century. The most unbelievable aspect of it is that it is something that we can get started on doing right now. Whether we will or not is not a technological question, it is a political question, and therefore one that I can't answer. Let's describe briefly what a first space colony would look like, and most of the lecture is going to be about a prototype space colony, just by way of convincing you that it can in fact be done, using the engineering studies that have been done in that direction. And then later on, at the very end, we'll talk about what can come of it a little bit further on. This particular colony is basically a sphere with things added to it, and there is a sphere. Gerard O'Neill, who is, or at least was at one time, partial to this particular idea, this particular design, calls it a Bernal sphere, after J.D. Bernal, who described a certain prototype of it back in the 1930s. It is obsolete, as I said, and I'll tell you why in a moment, but the people would live on the inside of the sphere. It would rotate. The idea of a space colony is to provide as Earth-like an environment as possible, because we know that human beings are adapted to live in an Earth-like environment. One gravity, the kind of atmosphere they're used to here, the amount of sunlight that they're used to here, on the day-night cycles they're used to here, and so forth. We do not know that humans are adapted to any other kind of environment. And so, at least for the first colony, we certainly want to play it safe and try to reproduce conditions that we're used to here as well as we can. Some of those are easier than others. The gravity turns out to be quite easy if you go to a slightly different design than this. The atmosphere is a little harder, but it's not impossible. Other portions of the space colony include things like these are radiators to get rid of excess energy, and these are solar energy collectors. They're large mirrors, just the way they look, to collect sunlight and beam it through glass windows made from lunar materials into the inside of the colony. And then at the two ends, you have, in addition to the radiator bins, you have industries and processing plants and so forth, which take advantage of space conditions. These are agricultural regions. It turns out that you can do agriculture extremely well under a controlled environment, better, in fact, than you can in the changing and unpredictable climates that we have on the Earth. These are literally artificial worlds. They are built literally from the ground up. In fact, you build the ground itself. And so they would be utterly controllable. You could have any climate that you wanted inside them. You could have different climates in the agricultural regions than you do in the living regions. And that turns out to be a good idea. Plants like very hot, extremely humid, unpleasantly high in carbon dioxide atmospheres. Things that human beings don't like, but the plants thrive especially well in. And you could stagger your growing seasons in the various agricultural regions, which is why there's more than one of them, so that at any given moment, any given vegetable or fruit that you wanted would be in season. You could have other colonies elsewhere, and they could very well be on different time zones than you, different climate, different sociological structure, different language, different whatever you want. It has a great deal of variety. The inside of the colony can be essentially anything that you want it to be, and what life in a space colony is like is limited only by the imagination of the designers and the people who eventually build it and live in it. Here's an artist's conception of the inside of the Bernal sphere. This is still a relatively small space colony, and so the houses are relatively crowded together, and the architects have got a number of ingenious solutions to avoid feeling as though you're living in some sort of anthill. They have gone to, for example, some extremely pleasant villages in the south of France and elsewhere on the Mediterranean coast, where there are very high population densities, like 10 or 20 times as great as you have even in downtown Detroit, and yet which are universally agreed as much more pleasant places to live in than, say, downtown Detroit, just because the people over the centuries have intuitively evolved some of these notions which the architects are now taking over from them. For example, you arrange your houses in a series of terraces so that my roof is your front garden, and you don't have the feeling that I'm living down there under you. You have the feeling that you're stepping out into your front garden and there's simply a vista of space out in front of you. You've been looking inside across to the other side of the colony. You can see that even at the beginning, you could have things like a river. Of course, it would be artificial, but it could be made as pretty as you wanted. Trees, verdant gardens, parks. You would have things that you never have in an earth environment because of the control of gravity. Since you're rotating the sphere to provide artificial gravity by the phenomenon which is universally, although incorrectly, referred to as centrifugal force. It is neither centrifugal nor a force, in fact, but you know what I mean. The spherical geometry would give you a varying gravity, and the highest gravity would be down at the equator of the sphere, and then as you walk up the hill, so to speak, it wouldn't feel like walking up a hill because the gravity would be getting less and less as the hill got steeper and steeper. And that is the way mountain climbing should definitely be in any environment. Unfortunately, it's not in terms of the planet. When you got up to the central axis, you would have a zero gravity environment, and you would be able to do things like building yourself a low-gravity swimming pool, and I think you can imagine some of the sheer fun that would be possible under those circumstances. You could also do things, assuming that adequate safety precautions were maintained, such that are forever hopeless dreams on the surface of the Earth. For example, easy, routine, human-powered flight for anybody. You simply climb up to the place where the gravity is zero, and then launch yourself off and fly through the air with your own wings, with your own muscle power. As I say, it would be necessary to take safety precautions. If you were to fly down near one of the high gravity regions, which would then be moving past you rapidly, you would be a definite traffic hazard, but probably nothing more difficult than a simple safety net would be sufficient for that. And I mention this kind of thing deliberately to point out that it would be fun to live in a space colony. At least it could be if the people wanted it to be. And it is not the kind of thing that we are conditioned to thinking of as living in space, a life of privation in a set of environments which are cramped and unpleasant, look like the inside of a submarine. Our early primitive simple space stations like Skylab were necessarily that way. But in this one, well, you see there in the foreground a bunch of people having a dinner party, which I am told is modeled after the traditional end-of-the-season party, which has marked the end of each of the summer studies that NASA has sponsored Ames Research Center south of San Francisco to look at this concept in detail. And each of the last three summers has had one. The history of the concept, briefly, at least in its modern form, has been this. People had always thought, if they thought in terms of moving away from the Earth at all, in terms of living on another planet. But the problem is, first of all, other planets are not pleasant places to live. Even the Earth is not a totally ideal place to live. Phone your friend in Boston right now and ask, and you will get some notion of what I mean, not to mention the way we got it last week. The Earth is a place that is pleasant in many respects, is awe-inspiring, grandiose in many respects, but it can do nasty things to you, too. The other planets are far worse. Where are you going to go? Venus, with a 900-degree surface temperature, day and night, summer and winter, probably equator and pole as well. Or Mars, where it gets so cold that every winter one-third of the planet's atmosphere freezes solid and falls on the ground as a snow cap, frozen carbon dioxide. And those two are the most Earth-like planets in the solar system. All the others are even more alien than that. There has, of course, been speculation about terraforming, that is, doing things with either biological engineering or something else. Presumably we're talking about several centuries into the future, terraforming these planets to make them more livable. But even if you did things like that, and surely you would not be able to do it immediately, surely at the beginning you'd have to end up living in things like dome cities or just go underground altogether, The other planets don't really give you a whole lot of relief for things like population pressure. They may have resources that we need, and if so, we may very well end up colonizing them anyway. So far, there seems to be no indication of that, but of course, so far, we don't know very much about them yet. But all of the terrestrial planets in the solar system added up, even if we use every last square inch of their surfaces, would give us only a few times the surface area of the Earth. And human beings could fill in that area in a very rapid time, and we'd be just as bad off as we are now. But this has always been the idea. We live on a planet, the other things that are out there are planets, and so that's where we're going to move. In 1974, there came a publication, which in fact the guy had been trying to get published for a number of years, and apparently kept running into people with future shock every time he submitted it to one journal after another, which proposed the idea of space colonization. And the central key to it is you don't go to planets that already exist. You build your own artificial worldlets, small asteroids, several miles or several tens of miles in size, using material that comes from a low-gravity environment. And the reason I keep stressing that is, well, the moon was this person that I'm talking about. His name is Gerard O'Neill and is a physics professor at Princeton and is the father of at least the modern version of the space colonization idea. He thought in terms of the moon and eventually the asteroid. One of the big arguments in the field now is whether we ought to go on to the asteroids right away at the beginning, maybe even go out and capture our own and tow it into orbit around the Earth and use that as our material base. Talk about that a little bit later on. He pointed out something which is so obvious that it's easy to miss, and that is that it is far easier to land on and take off from, for example, the moon, than it is to land on and take off from the Earth. Because the moon, number one, has very much less gravity, and number two, has no air. So you can use things like rockets at their peak efficiency right there at the ground. You don't have to do what we have to do now in taking off from the Earth, which is fight your way up through that thick blanket of atmosphere, which prevents you from getting up to any kind of decent speed anywhere near the surface of the Earth. And you must do that before you are allowed to get off into space. You can't use a large, heavy, ground-based installation to launch you up into space. The fact that it's so easy to land on the moon and take off from it was kind of concealed during Apollo, because of course there we had the worst of both worlds. We had to take off from the Earth first, and we had to land on the Earth at the end of the mission. But if you don't insist on coming back to the Earth every time, then going to the moon and taking off is very much easier than going to the Earth and taking off, which you can prove to yourself by just remembering what it took to do each of those during Apollo. Consider the enormous Saturn V rocket sitting there on the pad at Cape Canaveral, which was necessary to get off from the Earth, and compare that with a little bitty lunar module, which was all that they needed to land on and take off from the moon, and is so tiny and has a thrust that is so gentle from its rocket that it doesn't even have seats in it. The astronauts both landed and took off standing up, strapped in, but not sitting on couches. It's much easier to get down there onto the moon, and besides, there are more efficient ways of launching things off the moon than rockets once you build large structures up there. Electromagnetic devices, which I'll talk about in more detail, which can be built on the ground, and so they can be as large and heavy as you want. They don't have to take off into space themselves, just get payloads off into space. So the moon is really a nice place just because it is so airless and so small and so unfriendly by the standards of people who want to live there. But the idea is not to live there. The idea is to get materials from there and then take them into space where energy is so freely available. Let's take a look at both of those concepts in a little bit more detail. I was telling you the history of it and then kind of got sidetracked. O'Neill had originally had the idea in 1969, which of course was a historic year for another reason. That was the first landing on the moon. He had it not because he was working for NASA. I think this is significant. The idea didn't come to any of the people that work for the space agency. It didn't come to any of the tens of thousands of people who work in their aerospace industries and are paid to think of these things. It came to him, to Gerard O'Neill, teaching physics at Princeton, because he was searching for an intriguing problem that might be a little bit more fun than the ordinary to capture the attention of his freshman physics class. And he happened, by sheer accident, in working on a problem for his freshman physics class, to stumble on what has got to be the greatest discovery of the space age, the fact that we can do this and that we can do this now. And then it took him several years to get it published. Since then, however, there has been a lot of ferment about it. There have been three successive summer studies, as I mentioned, each of them more elaborate than the last. We are honored tonight to have in the audience John Scheffler, who was the chief of one of the working groups, the one concerned with environmental controls within the space colonies, at the last summer study, the 1977 one, the final one of the three. And he has very kindly consented to join me during the question period to answer any questions that you have that may be too technical for me, which is very easy to do because there are so many disciplines involved in this subject that there's no way that a poor, unfortunate popularizer like myself can be expected to be expert in all of them. Let's go back to the moon and see how we do this. This is a pie diagram of what typical lunar material was made of. It's from the Apollo 16 landing site, which was probably the most typical on the entire moon. And it is it is not by number of atoms, it's by weight. And so oxygen doesn't take up as much as it actually should if you did it by number of atoms. The oxygen atoms don't weigh as much as these do. Actually, oxygen, believe it or not, is going to be the easiest thing to find. In fact, so easy that you are going to be faced with embarrassing surpluses of the stuff. Just the opposite of the old science fiction cliche about running out of oxygen in space. They are working very hard to dream up ways of using this oxygen, which is going to be a considerable waste product from the processing of the lunar material. Two-thirds of the atoms in the lunar rocks and soil are oxygen. And I know from experience that amazes people, so I'll tell you a little-known geologic fact, little-known among the general public, that is, and that is exactly the same thing is true of the Earth. The commonest atom in the solid body of the Earth that you walk around on every day is oxygen. And in fact, the oxygen atoms have to be bulkier than the others, and the result is that 95% of the volume of the solid body of the Earth is oxygen atoms. Picture the Rock of Gibraltar standing there looking so solid. All it is just a big pile of oxygen atoms held together by impurities. And the same thing is true of the solid ground that you're walking around on, or will if the snow ever melts. Here in Michigan as well. So oxygen is the least of your problems. Lunar materials are also rich in metals, lots of aluminum in the highland soils from Apollo 16, lots of titanium, iron, and magnesium in the mare soils. For those of you who aren't familiar with these terms, the moon, as you can see by simply glancing at it with the naked eye when it's full, is divided into the dark areas that form the face of the man and the moon, and those are called maria. And they're made of a different kind of rock than the remainder, the light areas, which are called the highlands, and form the background. And it so happens that one of the very best places to set up your lunar mining operation is right near the boundary between a mare and a highland, and in fact not terribly far, by sheer coincidence, from the Apollo 11 landing site, the first one back in 1969. So that's a nice coincidence, and it means that you've got both kinds of rocks. You have silicon, and you can combine that with the oxygen to make glass. What you don't have on the moon is things like hydrogen and nitrogen, and those are, and also carbon, which is not shown in this diagram. Those are important because those are the things that you use to synthesize plastics, the equivalents of petrochemicals, which can be synthesized very easily if you have enough energy, and actually a good deal of the engineering work has gone into finding, and this is something that's going to just slay all the people in the audience who are, say, my age or older, substitutes for plastics. Remember back when plastics were substitutes? Now they're so essential to our culture that the engineers designing these space colonies have had to go into a good deal of trouble to find out what you can use instead. But it turns out there's quite a bit that you can. In fact, the lunar materials themselves, the basaltic rocks from the Maria, can be used to make a product that's been made in France for centuries and serves as an excellent ceramic, and you can do with it anything that you can do with ceramics, and that is cast basalt. You take some basaltic rock and you melt it, and you then re-solidify it in whatever shape you want using a mold, and so you can make it into bathroom tiles or pots or whatever it is that you ordinarily want ceramics for. Basalt is a flat, dull, unpleasant looking stuff, so you're going to have to glaze it or paint it or do some such thing, but that's what the ceramics people are for, and they're very good at it. So, most of the material for the colony, which is this pie diagram here, and is identified as L5 after an early suggestion for where it might be put, say what L5 is a bit later on, exclusive of shielding. That's the cosmic ray shielding. Cosmic rays are a problem in space. They're a more serious problem than O'Neill realized originally, but in contrary attention to that, almost all the other things that he thought in his original paper were going to be problems have turned out to melt one after another. And cosmic rays are really the only one that gave him very much trouble, and that's not too much trouble, because what you do is you simply build yourself a big shield around the colony made of the slag from the processing of these lunar materials. The majority of the lunar materials for this first colony then, would come from the moon. These are the ones, hydrogen, nitrogen, and also carbon, which would have to come from the Earth. Let's take an example of that. Suppose that you want water, which obviously you're going to need, not only for drinking, but for all the other things that water is needed for in an ecosystem and for industrial purposes. Well, there is zero water on the moon, so far as we know. There is a faint possibility that there may, actually a fairly good possibility, that there may be deposits of frozen water up near the lunar poles. And one of the disappointments of the budget, federal budget, with the NASA portion of it, which President Carter submitted last week, is that once again, one of the most badly needed missions, Lunar Polar Orbiter, an unmanned spacecraft to survey the entire moon from orbit, do extensive geochemical surveys of it, of the sort of thing that was done from orbit during Apollo for a limited portion of the moon with instruments on the command service module, Lunar Polar Orbiter has again been deleted from the budget. And so we have to wait one more year now before we have it. Lunar Polar Orbiter would be equipped to find this frozen water up near the poles if it exists. But certainly there is no water elsewhere on the moon, not even in parts per billion buried within the rocks themselves. And on Earth, any rock would have water in it. That is, in fact, a major geochemical difference between the moon and the Earth. The major difference between them as far as what they're made of is concerned. So how do you get water? Well, water consists of hydrogen and oxygen. The formula for it, as probably most of you know, is H2O, which means that a water molecule is two atoms of hydrogen and one of oxygen. There's plenty of oxygen in the lunar soil, but you say, gee, that doesn't do us too much good because after all, two-thirds of a water molecule are those two hydrogen atoms, and those are not on the moon. So what are you going to do? You are simply going to look at the fact that although two-thirds of the molecule by number of atoms may be hydrogen, a hydrogen atom weighs a great deal less than an oxygen atom, and so all you have got to do is get hydrogen from the Earth. In fact, you probably get it from the oceans, but you're putting water. Carry the hydrogen, which is lightweight, up to your space colony, and use the heavy oxygen from the moon. And 16/18 of the weight of a water molecule is that oxygen. So in fact, even though you have no hydrogen, let alone water, on the moon, you can synthesize water without very much trouble. The same thing is true for other areas, and so you see we get nitrogen from the atmosphere, we get hydrogen from the oceans, and we carry those up to the space colony. Before terribly long, maybe even at the very beginning, we will abandon the moon as a site for space colonization material and go on out to the asteroids. Astronomers have been studying the asteroids in detail as much as they can from the Earth. One of the problems about going to the asteroids right away is, although they're a better material than the moon, they are not as well known. We don't have samples back from them. And so if we do start using the asteroids, this is going to have to be preceded by some missions going out there, some scientific missions going out there and getting samples. But spectral studies from the Earth have shown within the last few years a rather surprising fact, and that is that not just some of the asteroids, but actually a majority of them are made of the same material as the class of meteorites called carbonaceous chondrites. Now, you've probably never heard of those unless you're into astronomy, but they're extremely interesting for a whole bunch of reasons, and I will now forcibly restrain myself from giving you a whole lecture on why carbonaceous chondrites are interesting, because believe me, they are, for a bunch of reasons that have nothing to do with space colonization. What's relevant here is that they have not only all the good things that you have in the moon in their rocky portions, they also have a great deal of water in them in the form of water of hydration, and in addition, they are chock full of organic substances. Now, don't get excited about that for the wrong reason. They are, when I say organic, that does not mean that these substances were created by living things. The word organic, as used in chemistry, means the class of complex carbon-based molecules which includes those substances that living things are made of, but is not restricted to them. and we can show chemically that these substances in the carbonaceous chondritic meteorites, and presumably in the asteroids, which seem to be made of the same kind of stuff, are not material that was synthesized by living things. They're still very exciting because that shows that there were complex molecules which were the building blocks of living things existing in the solar system even before the planets had formed. We think the carbonaceous chondrites date back that far, 4.6 billion years. But they are rich in organic substances, and that means that you've got your hydrogen, you've got your nitrogen, you go to the asteroids, and you can make this pie diagram 100% from space material, and so we want to do that as quickly as possible. Carbonaceous chondritic meteorites, and presumably the asteroids that are similar to them, are as rich in organic substances as some oil shales, so they're good things. But for the time being, we're going to talk in terms of going to the moon, because that's what the engineering studies up to this point have mostly concentrated on, and also because it may turn out to be the best way to go for the first space colonies, just because the moon is nearer to us, easier to get to, and is better known at this particular moment. I don't think there's any doubt we'll go to the asteroids in the long run. How about energy? This is a diagram that I am not going to attempt to explain to you in detail. Believe me, in the first place, it would obviously take the rest of the night and 6 days following. In the second place, I'm simply not confident to go through most of this diagram. The idea of showing it to you is simply to point out that this is a block diagram of how you start out with ordinary lunar soil, not special, nothing separated out from anything else in any particular way, and using that beautiful free energy that you have in space, you make all the various substances that you want. For example, here is where you are making glass, and here is where... And the final diagram would be 10 times as complex as this, but there doesn't seem to be very much question about the fact that it can be done. There's no question about the fact that it can be done. The only questions are what are the very best ways to do it. And all of this diagram, in fact, just by way of being conservative, uses techniques that are already known on the Earth. And of course, it would be silly when you build your space colony not to take advantage of the fact that you have not only all that beautiful free energy in space, you also have zero gravity, which allows you to build substances, alloys of immiscible materials, for example, that cannot be constructed on Earth. You have unlimited amounts of vacuum for all sorts of kinds of processing that on Earth are difficult or too expensive to be possible. You have unlimited amounts of heat and cold simply for the concentration of the sunlight or the getting into a shadow, and you can take advantage of those to do unearthly industrial processes, which would be very much more efficient than some of the detailed things shown in this diagram. I want to point out, though, perhaps the most startling aspect of this to a person that's not familiar with the concept, and that is that we are not using special ores. We're not using material of anything at all unusual or concentrated. We are using ordinary lunar soil, simply picked up in buckets and delivered as it is raw to the place where the material processing is going on, out in space as a space colony. The reason that it's possible to do that is the unlimited free energy. Ordinarily, if you want iron, you don't think of the fact that there is iron in lots and lots of common rocks in the dirt in your backyard. No, you go to a place where the iron has been concentrated by relatively rare natural processes into what we call an ore. And if you worry about running out of iron, what you're really worried about is running out of iron ore. There are as many iron atoms on the Earth as there ever were. But the reason it's necessary to use ores on the Earth is that the most expensive portion of the processing of a substance like iron out of the form that you find it in nature is the energy that is required to get it out, to eliminate the atoms that you don't want that are chemically combined with it, separate out the atoms that you do want, in this case the iron. You could use rock or soil if it was necessary. And during World War II, where a number of crucial substances were in short supply in the United States and in the West in general because the enemy had denied our access to the ores. Some of these substances are from ores that there just isn't very much of on the Earth. Quite a bit of work was done in getting out atoms that were desired from ordinary rocks and soil without having to find them concentrated in ores. And it turns out that this can be done even on Earth. with only about, in a typical case, 10%, 20% less efficiency than if you start out with an ore. Now, if you're U.S. Steel, and it's not a special circumstance like wartime, and you are doing something that is 10% or 20% less efficient than your competitors, you're going to get out of business. And so that's the reason that U.S. Steel is still out there looking for ore. But the difference is not all that great. And since it is a relatively small difference, go into space where you get all this free solar energy, and it disappears entirely. And so you don't have to worry about finding ore bodies on the moon, and that is a good thing because they almost certainly are not there. The geochemistry of the origin of ores is a very complex subject, and in fact, there's a lot that we still don't know about it. But one thing that seems to be pretty clear is most of the ores that exist on Earth owe their origin in one respect or another to the unusual fact that there is liquid water in great abundance on this planet. You're not going to have that on the moon, and so you're not going to have ores on the moon, almost certainly, unless, of course, there are non-terrestrial geochemical processes that create different kinds of them up there that we just haven't run into yet. So far, there's no reason to believe that there is. But it doesn't matter. The lunar basalts are, for example, so rich in titanium that any old chunk of basalt lying around on the ground at the Apollo 11 site, particularly, is a commercial grade of titanium ore if it were on the Earth. And most other substances are not that richly concentrated in the lunar soil, but there is no question whatsoever that we can get them out using that free sunlight. I keep talking about this free sunlight, and I'm sure an idea of something that's going through your head in many cases is, why can't we use solar energy that way here on the Earth? Well, here is a slide which gives part of the answer. This is a diagram which shows the amount of energy that comes in from the sun at the various wavelengths at which the sun emits energy. And visible wavelengths are in through here. The total area under the curve is the total amount of energy that is emitted by the sun. And in fact, only about half of that total energy gets through the Earth's atmosphere to the surface. But it's even worse than that. On the ground, first of all, it's night half the time. The sun is not shining. On Earth, and in space, as soon as you get far enough away from the Earth that you are never or almost never in the Earth's shadow, it is daytime 24 hours a day. The sun is always up there. Furthermore, on Earth, since you have a heavy gravitational field, you've got the problem that either you must have your solar energy collectors lying flat on the ground, or you, if you're going to track the sun across the sky, and it insists on moving across the sky once per day on the surface of this planet, there seems to be nothing we can do about it, some union restriction or something. The devices which do the tracking have got to be large and heavy, and because you have got weather on this planet, even the things lying flat on the ground have got to be fairly large and heavy and bulky. The sun moves across the sky during the course of a day. Only if the sun were directly overhead would the light from it be shining directly down onto the ground. At any other time of the day, the light is coming in at some angle. It is spreading itself out over the ground more thinly than it would if the sun were overhead, and therefore it is diluting itself. In space, you can always point your energy collector directly at the sun. Furthermore, there is no weather in space, and so if you want a nice, simple, cheap, efficient solar energy collector, well, all you got to do is build yourself a few dozen square miles of aluminum foil, for example, out of aluminum and oxygen, which are available on the moon, and something as flimsy as that can be used with no further protection. On Earth, in a desert environment, why, that would simply last until the first dust storm. But in space, okay, after 100 years, micrometeorites would hit it to the point where you have to throw it away and start over. In the meanwhile, that 100 years, you've had yourself a solar energy collector. For all those reasons, the fact that even in the most cloud-free desert areas on Earth, there are clouds occasionally, and there are dust storms more than occasionally, and there's atmospheric absorption all the time, especially when the sun is not directly overhead. For all of those reasons, not just twice as much solar energy is available out there in space, but the amount of, as on Earth, but the amount of solar energy which passes in a given time period, say a year, through a given area, say a square foot, of space at the Earth's distance from the sun is 10 times as great as the amount that passes through a square foot of even the most cloud-free desert areas on the Earth. And that factor of 10 is the difference between making solar energy economically competitive and not. Solar energy has always been identified by everybody that's looked into the energy crisis problem as the most ecologically desirable form because it is non-polluting, number one. Gathering it does not produce any pollution. And number two, it is inexhaustible. The sun is going to be shining for 5 billion years. But the problem is that on Earth, it is just dilute enough that all of the studies of viable energy sources for example, the year 2000, have concluded that, okay, solar energy may be wonderful if you're an ecologist, but from a sheer economic point of view, it is much more expensive than any of the others. But gathering space using large solar energy collecting satellites built in space colonies, you could build them on the ground using Earth materials and haul them up through the Earth's atmosphere. And in fact, there's a proposal to do exactly that in the news this very day. I heard it on the radio as I was driving over here. Wonderful idea. I hope there's a lot to talk about it. But that is much more expensive. You build them in space. You collect the energy in space. And even though you have got to go to the expense of building a lunar mining base and a space colony before you can make your solar energy collecting satellite, the electricity derived from that source, even though its cost includes the cost of building the space colony and the lunar mining base and the satellites themselves, would be something of the order of 1/5 as expensive as any other energy source that's been identified for the year 2000. And that includes breeder reactors with all the ecological problems that they very probably will pose. That includes coal, which of course is ecologically nasty, both when you mine it and when you burn it. It includes fusion. Fusion is the one that's the most uncertain. We don't know how much it would cost since we don't have it yet, but it is almost certainly not going to be competitive with space-generated solar. And of course, space-generated solar is fusion in a sense. You're just letting the sun do the fusion for you. So for all these reasons, both the space colonies themselves and the people down on the Earth will be able to use solar energy in a way that is far more efficient than we would be able to use it if we were to stay here on the Earth and try to collect it down here on the surface of the ground. This is one concept for a solar energy generating satellite. It is the concept of Peter's laser. This is, it's a geosynchronous orbit, so that it always stays over the same spot on the Earth, and that's where it transmits its energy to. This is the photovoltaic version, the one that uses solar cells, and of course they're the big glamour items in space technology as far as energy collection is concerned. The problem with them is they're ridiculously expensive. It is possible that by the time we'd be ready to do this, which would be early 1990s at the earliest, that there will be breakthroughs in their construction and we'll be able to make them cheaply and in reasonable prices in large quantities, but we can't be certain of that. And I do mean large quantities. There's nothing in this picture to indicate the scale. This particular satellite is 13 miles long and 7 miles wide, and it has a retransmitting antenna which sends the energy down to the Earth after it's been collected, turned into electricity by the photovoltaic cells. It is converted to radio waves. Those radio waves are beamed down to the surface of the Earth where a large antenna will collect them, and that antenna itself, which does the transmission, is 1,300 feet in diameter. Well, solar cells are nice and glamorous and space age and fancy and all that, but they may not turn out to be practical. There is another way of collecting solar energy, which is intelligibly primitive and which in fact was demonstrated in a working version as far back as the 1890s, but it works. And we may very well go to that instead, and that is simply having big mirrors which generate the energy and focus it onto, collect it into a focus where it drives some sort of steam generator. It's easy, it's simple, it's straightforward, and it may be low technology, but it operates just fine. Each of these dishes is 2 miles in diameter, so that the entire thing, there are four of them there, is 8 miles long. The transmitting antenna is again 1,300 feet in diameter. The focus is heated to a temperature of several thousand degrees. Some working fluid, probably not water, they're more efficient ones at that high temperature, would be vaporized by all that heat and caused to run a turbine. Again, the energy would be converted into electricity and then into radio waves and beamed down to the Earth. Either way, it would be collected on the Earth by an antenna farm, which would look something like this. And the artist has painted in several miles across the artist has painted in clouds deliberately to indicate that there are radio frequencies to which the atmosphere and even clouds and even rain or snow is 100% transparent. Those radio frequencies are in the microwave region of the spectrum. And so we are talking about a very intense microwave beam of energy coming down onto the surface of the Earth from space. And of course, everybody's first reaction to that is, it's a death ray, and if anything goes wrong, it is going to sap us all. And we have the picture of the energy collecting satellite up there in the space for some reason losing its lock on the target, and the beam leaving a trail of incandescent destruction across the countryside. It ain't gonna happen. The energy density of the microwave cannot be made by the laws of physics greater than about the energy density of ordinary sunlight on a sunny day, which would be falling down on the same portion of the ground. And so if you were standing there, it would not be a good idea for a long time. It might zap your chromosomes eventually, but the only security precaution that would be needed would be a chain link fence, and that has been indicated around the edge there. And it's actually to walk under the antenna with perfect safety. And at these particular wavelengths, the antenna does not have to be made of solid plates so that sunlight can go through a mesh antenna grid system, even though the microwaves are all trapped by it. And so you can even grow crops underneath the antenna if you wanted to. I imagine that's not the way it will be done. They probably build these things out in some wasteland area that nobody needs for much else anyway, if for no other reason than that the land is cheaper out there. But you do not have to use up any of the Earth's surface that you don't want to throw away anyway. The danger of the beam is not great. For the reason that I said, and also for another reason, which I'm not going to try to explain in detail because some of you know physics and you understand what I mean right away when I describe it, and the rest of you don't, and it would take a whole physics lecture. If you know anything about constructive and destructive interference, it is possible, it is easy to arrange the beam in such a way that if it is on target, then you get a focused beam, and if it drifts off target by the least little bit, immediately the beam totally defocuses and is radiated into an entire hemisphere from the point of view of the transmitting antenna up there on the satellite that is doing it, and then the radiation which is reaching the Earth is no more than what you're getting from all the radio stations whose waves are zapping through you right now and doing no obvious harm unless you actually have a radio and start listening to some of this stuff. This refers only to certain stations, of course. And certainly not the ones that have me on. The primary danger, then, the one that everybody worries about first, is one that simply is not going to happen. And you couldn't turn this into a war weapon, even if you deliberately tried. That, however, may not be the entire story. And there are areas in this concept which require more research. I've already mentioned a couple, and here's another one. The second order ecological effect of sending down this energy in this particular way. For example, what I mean by second order effect is this. The nuclear power people had a real problem with that, because back when nuclear reactors were first suggested as power sources, the first order effect that everybody always thought of was, can the thing blow up like a nuclear bomb? And it's very easy to show, no, it cannot. And the problem was, they stopped there. And they didn't consider that there might be more subtle effects, that's what I call second-order effects, which could be more of a problem, and now some of those are coming back to haunt them. And I don't want to get into the controversy about whether that's true or not. The point is, it's coming back to haunt them, and they're having a lot of problems about it, because they didn't do enough homework on the second-order effects back then. So here are some questions that we still have to answer. Suppose that birds are attracted to these antennae by the fact that it is warmer there because of the microwaves. And they build their nests, and they lay their eggs, and they raise their young. What happens after that's gone on for 10 generations? Does anything happen to the birds? If so, how do you chase them away? That kind of thing. It seems extremely unlikely that any of those second-order effects would be severe enough to shoot down the idea, but of course, the nuclear power people probably would have said that 20 years ago, too, and it's something that definitely has to be looked into. But I certainly hope that it doesn't, because this is the only ecologically viable energy source that I have heard of that could keep us going at anything like the standard of living that we have pleased ourselves to become accustomed to for very much longer. Here is a study of various present and possible future energy systems, and the cost in mils, that is tenths of a cent, per kilowatt hour of electricity generated from each one of them, from the kinds of nuclear reactors that we have now on up through some slightly fancier things, no ground-based solar, and no doubt this box is the uncertainty, and there's the what they thought was the most likely value for the cost. Notice how that is far more expensive than any of the others. And then even when you get into things like breeder reactors and some possible versions of fusion, you get expenses which are a good deal more than space-based solar, all of which is down about at this level on the scale of this particular diagram. Now, I cannot overemphasize the importance of cheap energy, not only to get hot in the relatively rich countries out of the present problems that we're in, but, even more, to get people in the developing countries out of the problems that they are in. The major cost of most of the things that they need to pull themselves into the 20th century and raise their standards of living up to some decent material level, the major cost of almost everything is energy. I mentioned a specific example of that. The major cost of agriculture is the energy that's required to do things like build fertilizers. And if you have cheap energy that is made available, of course you know how it's going to go historically. It's going to be the rich people that get it first, right? I mean, the United States is going to build the first one, or Russia is going to build the first one, or maybe a consortium of nations, but it's still going to be dominated by the rich ones, is going to build the first one, and they're going to get the energy first. But then sooner or later, they'll get to the point where it becomes cheaper politically to give the poor people a share of the pie than to go on hogging it for ourselves. And that's the way it'll be spread out. I'm not invoking any sort of superhuman altruism. Yeah, we do the same sort of thing with the Panama Canal. Morally, you can make out an excellent case for us keeping the Panama Canal. After all, we dug the thing ourselves, and before that, we gave the country of Panama its independence ourselves. But that's totally irrelevant. We're going to have to give them the canal, because we're not about to fight a war over that stupid ditch with a bunch of poor Panamanians that everybody in the world would perceive as the underdog. Yeah, it's going to be the same sort of thing here. Sooner or later, the poor people are going to get their share of this energy as well, when it's gotten to the point where there are so many of those satellites up there, and the electricity has become so cheap that it doesn't cost us very much to give it to them. And that will have more of an effect on their lifestyle than any other single thing that I can think of in the material sphere that we could do for them. Get into things like education, or get into things like the moral sphere, you know, that's another concern. But cheap energy is what they really need as far as material things go. Not everything about this is going to be good. As an astronomer, I do not like what it is going to do to the night sky. In fact, this art of concept probably doesn't give you any conception of what it's going to look like, because already with just Skylab, which is only about the length equivalent to the height of an 8-story building, it became equal to all of the very brightest of the stars. And these things are going to be tens of miles in size, and there are going to be hundreds of them up there. But nobody seems to worry very much about what happens in the night sky except astronomers, and certainly suggestions to turn off all the streetlights and give us an evening sky would probably be greeted with horror in a crime-conscious area such as Detroit, so I expect it's going to be done anyway. It may be possible that, after all, the side is toward the sun that is supposed to be the reflective side, and that, if it is reflective, is going to concentrate its energy onto its focus, not waste energy by reflecting some of it down to the Earth. Maybe it'll be possible to prevail on them to paint the other side black and therefore reduce this. I'll tell you one advantage that it'll have, though. It'll be really great for people lost in the woods that don't know enough astronomy to know the North Star. You may not be able to find the North Star, but it'll be pretty hard to miss that in the sky. That line will stretch from the east point on the horizon to the west point on the horizon. So there will be no question in the mind of anybody on any clear night which way is east and which way is west. Let's go to space. This is the way it is not going to happen. And the reason that I say that is this is in the nature of an existence proof. That is to say, the engineering studies and the eight summer studies that I told you about have deliberately set out to work out in a fair amount of detail, enough to convince everybody that yes, it really can be done, and we haven't overlooked something, we haven't swept something under the rug. They worked out a design in which it can be done with present-day technology using the sort of things that we know now. And of course, since we're talking about doing this something like the early 1990s, maybe 15 years or more from now, of course there will have been many breakthroughs since then. And so this design and this scheme of doing things is sort of like the books on how we are going to go to the moon that came out, say, in the 1950s. In detail, they were wildly wrong. In concept, they were correct. And their importance was that they were capable of convincing people that, yes, it was indeed possible. This is the most viable design that's come up so far for a small space colony, a first one that allows 10,000 people. And we're still talking about that particular portion of the history of the entire scheme. This is called the Sanford Torus. Torus is a mathematical name for a donut shape or a bicycle wheel shape. And it is the best. Is the best, most viable design for this reason. Remember, we started out with a sphere. The problem is that you are rotating the space colony to give yourself artificial gravity by, quote, centrifugal force, end quote. Rotation is not the natural way that we get gravity here on the Earth. We have real gravity. And rotation produces vertigo. All those cute little canals in the inner ear do not like being inside an environment that is spinning around. If you imagine living the rest of your life on a roller coaster, I think you can get the idea. It may be fun for short periods, but you probably wouldn't want to do it for the rest of your life. It turns out, in the physiological studies that have been done, and of course, quite extensive physiological studies, of how much of various environmental extremes humans can tolerate has been done as a result of the necessity for knowing what astronauts could put up with. It turns out that although some people can stand rotation rates that are relatively high, if you want to be democratic about this and build colonies that anybody can go to, that you and I can go to, or a peasant in Bangladesh can eventually go to, everybody can take rotation rates no greater than one revolution per minute. We have also stipulated that, at least for our Earth-based colonies, until we found out more about what humans can put up with for a long period, say the rest of their lives, that we want to make an Earth-like environment, and that means one Earth gravity. Well, there's a very simple equation that you can plug those two numbers into. Given that we require one Earth gravity with one RPM of rotation, it turns out that the diameter, which is required for rotating body, which is required to do that, is just over 1 mile. Now, that is a little large for building something that is completely enclosed and is that size. Because there's an awful lot of air, for example, in the middle of that enclosed space that you're not using for anything, and yet you've got to pay for it. You know, you've got to put all that air in there. So for a first colony, given that you must have 1 mile diameter, but other than that, it doesn't matter what the shape is, it seems reasonable to restrict the volume that has to be filled with air. And you think about it for a while, and you realize very quickly that you get rid of the sphere that way, you get rid of the cylinder that way, you get rid of everything except the torus. After a while, when we are building space colonies tens of miles in size, intended to house millions of people, it isn't going to matter what shape they are. And I'll show you examples of such space colonies a little bit later on. But for the beginning, you want to build yourself probably a torus and not a sphere. Here are the features of the torus. There is a central hub there, which serves as a sort of community meeting place. If you want to get from this side of the torus to that side of the torus, well, the obvious way to do it is to go through that spoke, which presumably would have some sort of transport system equivalent to an elevator. Almost certainly you would not have things like personal automobiles within the station, or within the colony. I just use a word which is inevitable, and don't get confused, please, between space stations and space colonies. Space stations are things that are very much smaller. So far, Skylab, whose final mission, by the way, ended 4 years ago today, and that was the longest that anybody's ever stayed in space so far, 84 days, and it looks very, very much as though the Russians are trying to break that record right now with their Soyuz-6 station. Those stations have had two people, one in the case of Soyuz-6, three people in the case of Skylab. Eventually, we'll have space stations that have several hundred people in them. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about towns or cities in space, whereas a space station is the equivalent of a house like Skylab, where it hosts a large office building. The central sphere there is a zero-gravity region. You might use some zero-gravity industries there. However, most of that, you want to get away from the living space entirely, and so you've got them down there at the end of a long tube that gets all the fuss and fumes away from everybody's noses. This is the remnant of the sphere that the people lived in who built the station, and that's the one place where the people that that were living did not live in particularly beautiful conditions. That's going to be very cramped. It's going to be a construction camp kind of atmosphere, and it will undoubtedly attract the kind of people that got jobs and say they left the pipeline. You know, and you're going to have to pay them for it, and they'll deserve it. And as with the Alaska pipeline, some of them will stay behind and join the colony, and some of them will move back home after it's finished. This is a radiator to get rid of waste heat. The artist has used some license there to show the lunar flag as a large rock. That's the cosmic ray shield. In fact, you don't use a large rock. It would be, remember, it's soil that you're processing, so it would be a granular size. And this is long, it's too small. This is a mirror to reflect sunlight down to a second set of mirrors, which in turn reflected in through glass windows on the inside of the wheel. And the reason that you've got all these mirrors is you want to allow sunlight to get in through those windows, but not allow cosmic rays to get in. And so you do that by using a set of mirrors, have it come in obliquely, and have it come in at the end through a set of overlapping panels, which are up at an angle, so that the sunlight can bounce off them and get inside, but the cosmic rays cannot bounce off them and go in a direction such that they don't hurt the people. Here is a cutaway view showing the inside of the San Pretoris, and you can see a living area in here. You may have noticed there were six folds altogether. The circumference of the wheel is divided into six regions, and each one has a spoke in its center, and the obvious thing to do about those is alternate living and working, agriculture, living, agriculture, and so forth, so that you can go through some country on the way to your job in another city if you wish to do so. The population density is quite high. Note the number of houses that are crowded together there, but it won't be obvious because they're using concepts like that bit about having one guy's roof being another guy's front yard. And a person who lives here, for example, would look out not on all the other humanity that's living down there below him, but a spacious view across to the other side of the colony. Here is the inside of those windows, and the overlapping chevron shields have not been very well shown in this particular diagram. First of all, you got to get the stuff into space, the things from the Earth, and you also have to have some sort of vehicle to shuttle back and forth between the Earth and the Moon and the space colony. The obvious thing to use for this is what we've already done a lot of money in building and designing and testing out, and that is our old friend the space shuttle in last week. You will recall, or you won't recall if you weren't here last week, and so you will learn now for the first time, that the shuttle consists of several sections. The orbiter, which is the part where the people and the cargo go, and you'll notice that there are 29 tons, 1,000 kilograms is just about an English ton, as well as a metric ton, 29 tons of payload in the orbiter. There are, 29,000 kilograms anyway. This is the external tank, which carries the fuel and oxidizer. These are the solid rocket boosters which help to get off the ground. This is the rear view of all that. There are three SSNE space shuttle main engines, which are very powerful and burn liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen from the fuel tank, and those are on the back of the orbiter. Okay. Use those components, particularly use the components which are expensive and difficult to design, for example, the SSNE. The first thing that you do is you build yourself a derivative of the shuttle in which you use the external tank and the solid rocket boosters without change and the space shuttle main engines back there, but you replace the orbiter with a throwaway truck, a container, which contains more than twice as much payload as the space shuttle orbiter is capable of doing. This does not have to return to the Earth, it's just a big shell, and so it's economic to throw it away, and that can be used to haul relatively small amounts of material into space. It turns out that it isn't enough. Remember, please, that we've got to haul up not only things like the construction shack to serve as a base for building the shuttle, we've also got to go all the way to the Moon many times, build ourselves a lunar mining base, and while that can be largely automated after it is built, it can be largely automated. Remember, there is never any variation on the Moon. There is no weather on the Moon. And so in that respect, you can build much more simply, and you can expect conditions, you can predict what the conditions are going to be much more so than you can do on the Earth, even though conditions on the Moon are more extreme than they are on the Earth. They're always unvarying. You've got to go with the lunar mining base. Okay, so in addition to this vehicle, which you use for some things, there is a still heavier vehicle. There is that one again. And here is one where you use four solid rocket boosters, four space shuttle main engines attached to the back of the external tank, and then a big shell up there in the front. And that is capable of carrying not the 29,000 kilograms of shuttle orbiter or the 65,000 kilograms of this version, but twice as much as that, 120,000 kilograms. And finally, you build yourself some vehicles which use a single space shuttle main engine. That's all that you need to get down the moon. Remember how easy that is. And have a central core where there is fuel, and then a number of shells on the outside to carry either passengers, who could be carrying quite large numbers of this thing, or cargo, which could be carried in very large quantities, and this would be entirely throwaway. Unfortunately, you've got to throw away the space shuttle main engine as well. And the reason for that is that after you've landed on the moon, there is no way to refuel the thing and get back from there. You will need some vehicles to get back from the moon, but you're not carrying large amounts of cargo back from the moon, just people as you're rotating the crews, and so that can be a good deal smaller of a vehicle. After you've built this fleet of transportation vehicles, the next thing to do is to build a construction shack, and that's just what it is. It's a shack. It is zero gravity, and the people that live in there and work in there and work very hard are hard hat type, and theirs is the glory, which they won't think of it that way, I'm sure, of building the first colony, and they will be very happy to move into that colony as soon as they've done so. You only have to do this once. After all, for building the second colony, you can use the first colony as a base. But for building the first colony, you've got to have something, and that will be the construction shack. Okay, meanwhile, here is what the lunar mining base looks like. As always, the artist has not been able to overcome the temptation to draw the Earth right next to the lunar horizon. In fact, that's not where it would be. The moon always faces the same side towards the Earth, and so the Earth does not rise or set in the lunar sky. It always stays at exactly the same place in the sky. So if it's on the horizon now, it'll always be on the horizon, and there is only one place on the moon where it looks like that, and that's the North Pole of the moon. The chances are that our lunar mining base will not be at the North Pole, although in fact, I should be a little bit easier on this artist. If it turns out that there is water up there, frozen water, it might turn out to be just exactly the best place to build it. But an engineer named T.A. Heppenheimer, whose name you'll hear a little bit later on because he wrote a very fine book on this subject that I intend to refer you to, has discovered that there is one place on the moon from which, if you launch the material into space from that one place, it is very much easier to collect it than any other place. And the details of that are sufficiently long to explain, and we are running sufficiently short on time that I'm not going to try to go into them. He does explain it quite modestly, in fact, in his book, but if you read between the lines, you can find out that he discovered it. And that particular place is down on the lunar equator, near, in fact, the Apollo 11 site. There is the hole which will supply the materials for the first space colony. Please understand, we are not messing up the lunar environment. All it's required to build an entire space colony capable of housing 10,000 people is digging one more crater, which is about 20 times the area of a football field by a few tens of feet deep, and that can be done largely by semi-automated vehicles, sort of like giant snow blowers, which handle the lunar snow and put it into vehicles that dump trucks will carry away. That crater is small enough that it will not be seen from the Earth through even the largest telescope that we have. And very quickly you move off the moon and onto the asteroids. And I don't think anybody's going to care about asteroids. There are so many of them that even if we use one up entirely, nobody's probably going to get very upset. The heart of the whole thing is this device there, which is called the mass driver. That is how you get your bags of lunar soil off the moon and into space. Remember, please, you do not do the processing. You don't get to do the extraction of the iron and the glass and the other things that you want down there on the moon. You do it out in space at the space colony itself because that's where the energy is cheap and, you know, it's night half the time on the moon just as it is on Earth. And that is also where you have zero gravity so you can handle large quantities of material more easily. So you do the only thing you do on the moon is mine the raw soil and send the raw soil off the moon in little buckets, probably about the size of a shoebox, about 1 to 2 of them per second, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, so that you are sending a total of 6 million tons of lunar material into space at the rate of 1 or 2 launches per second every year. The way you do it is by using this mass driver, which is something that you could build on the moon and never on the Earth. It accelerates the material up to lunar escape velocity right there at the surface of the moon. Lunar escape velocity is 1.5 miles per second, And the way that it does it is simply the way your doorbell works. The giant solenoid. A solenoid is a device where there are rings or there are coils. There is a helical coil, in this case it would be rings, which produce a magnetic field that has such a character that as the magnetic field changes, in the case of the doorbell, it changes once when you turn it on, once when you let it off. In this case, it will be changing continuously in pulses like the peristalsis in your intestine. Now that's a cute little analogy that I just thought of on the phone. The magnetic field causes a magnetized body, in the case of the doorbell, a rod, to move from one end of the coil to the other. And of course the doorbell is set up so that it slams into a bell when it goes down at the far end. In this case, what you have is bags of lunar soil, which are not particularly magnetic. They've got a little bit of magnetism, some magnetic material in the lunar soil, but not very much. So you put them into an iron container, a steel container, and those are expensive and valuable because they have to be transported to the moon, and so you want to get that back at the end. You zip it along the length of the thing, which would be several miles in length, and at the very end, you open up a door at the end of your little container, which is known by the romantic name of the bucket, and the soil bag goes flying off into space. You retrieve your container, cycle it back, and use it again, over and over and over and over and over. I think you see what I mean by saying that it could be very highly automated. That kind of thing is doing the same thing over and over again, and the mining isn't terribly much more difficult. The mass driver is an idea that goes all the way back to the 1940s, and it was invented by Arthur C. Clarke, the same guy who writes all the good science fiction and even better science fact, and the same guy who invented the idea of communication satellites. The concept has lain sort of dormant in the literature ever since because, you know, what can we do with it as long as we're all our takeoffs are from the Earth? But a prototype mass driver, I won't go into this in detail, we're running out of time. The most impressive feature of the way the mass driver would operate is the targeting accuracy, which would be equivalent to kicking a football from San Francisco to New York City and having to go through the goalposts. That targeting can be easily achieved on the air with the moon, it turns out. There's never any wind, and that's your big problem, that kind of accuracy on Earth. Bring it to the pocket, and there you see the coils which do the accelerating, and what happened was they put the bucket in there, and they turned the thing on, and it went whack! And the next thing you knew, it slammed into a soft target, and they head down there at the other end. To give you an idea of how some of the problems that O'Neill in the original paper thought were going to be more serious than in fact it turned out to be, and how wonderful the gods have been to us on this whole project, the original paper that O'Neill did thought that at most, the best you could ever do by way of acceleration for one of these mass drives would be 30 Gs. This student-built model did three times as well as that. And they are now talking confidently in terms of accelerations of several thousand G's from one of these mass drives. Now that is much more important than G, that's a big number. Because what it means is that for the same terminal velocity, you can make the gadget very, very much shorter. So much shorter that it's not only a reasonable device in a version several miles long with a relatively low acceleration to get things off the moon, it is also a reasonable device in a much shorter version, which gets much higher acceleration, as a propulsive mechanism for a very large spacecraft. And that, in fact, is how the studies that are now being done about how you pirate an asteroid visualizes doing it. You find yourself an asteroid whose orbit crosses the orbit of the Earth. And one of the recent discoveries in the last few years in asteroidal astronomy is there are many more of those than we had understood. We're going to pirate the thing, but it's going to hit the Earth anyway, naturally, within the next 200 million years. So, you know, we're not assuming anything's going to be around very long anyway, besides we're eliminating traffic hazard. You go out there, you build yourself a mass driver, and you start throwing pieces of the asteroid itself out into space. It's the most barbaric propulsion mechanism. I mean, you're so used to thinking in of advanced propulsion mechanisms in terms of, you know, really fancy things like ion drives and high-powered laser beams and so forth. And this is the thing out of Chapter 2 and all the elementary books on how space propulsion works, of the little man throwing a rock, throwing bricks off a sled on a lake, you know, and Newton's third law makes them go in the other direction. Here, all you're doing is throwing rocks into space, or anything that you want. In fact, this is one of the ways to get rid of that embarrassing surplus of oxygen. All right? You use it as a throwaway material in a mass driver in a propulsion system. The mass driver would of course have to, whatever you're throwing away, would have to be inside a magnetic bucket, but the material in the bucket could be anything that you wanted. Giving another couple of pictures very quickly of the student-built system. There is Professor Coleman himself. And there's a close-up of the bucket, their bucket. Now, the ones that you build on the moon are going to have refinements like superconducting coils, cool to liquid helium temperatures, and that sort of thing, and they didn't try to do that. But considering that it was built by a few students on a budget of about $2,000, literally over their Easter vacation, it's a very impressive accomplishment, and it certainly shows that it can be done. Okay, you have some sort of big bag out there at a particular place behind the moon called the second Lagrangian point of the Earth-Moon system to catch the bags of lunar soil, and since they would arrive at that point about 200 miles an hour, you have a grid of cables here so they will break up upon impact, and then the whole bag is rotating. It's a very large object. Notice there's the length of a football field. It is rotating so the quote centrifugal force end quote will plaster the stuff against the inside as it arrives. The rotary pellet launcher is another device which simply throws away small rocks to keep the mass catcher on station. There would be several of these, and they would shuttle back and forth. It would take about 2 weeks to fill one of them up, and it would then start moving very, very slowly over to the location where the space colony was built. And of course, there'd have to be another one on station to take up the stream of still incoming bag of soil. This is a diagram which shows the transfer trajectory from the L2 point. You'll loop around the moon a number of times, then loop around the Earth a number of times, and finally end up at the particular orbit, which this is a diagram from Tom Heppenheimer. He discovered this orbit in the first cloud, but it may or may not be the ones they use. And I'm running out of time, I can't describe everything in this, so I'm not going to tell you what it is. You know, read the book if you want to know all the details about the orbit. I can't tell you everything. The point is that there are a number of excellent orbits, locations in space in the Earth-Moon system to build a first colony, and so we're still fighting. They're still fighting over what would be the best one, and 50 years later, it isn't going to matter anyway. They're going to be building them all over the solar system. But the very first one you want to put in the very best orbit, and one of the great things about this is there is an embarrassment of good choices, and so it's hard to take out what is the very best one. This diagram is in a rotating coordinate system where the Earth and the Moon are always in the same place, and it's as though you had a rotating photograph record with the Earth in the center and a dot on it to represent the Moon, and you took a movie with the camera rotating at the same rate, okay? So the Moon is always at the same point in the picture, all right? And then you get this weird-looking trajectory. Okay, and I'm going to skip this too, because it tells what L4 and L5 were about, and that was, L5 was an early suggestion to build a colony, and the citizens group, which is interested in these things, called the L5 Society for that reason. There are probably much better places. Here is a painting by my favorite space artist, Don Davis, of the final stages of the construction of the San Pretorius. And you get an excellent view. This is on the inside of the wheel. Here are two of the spokes, and there is already some parkland that's been put in. You get an excellent view of the process of putting on the Chevron shield, which allows sunlight to get in but keep cosmic radiation out. There's a big mirror up there which is reflecting some of the spacecraft. And there it is, final version.
See, I thought it was too. It was all the space colony.
With a more reasonable mirror. Here's a picture inside in a downtown region. This is one of the working places as opposed to the living place, which would be a little bit further along there. Naturally, we've got to have a monorail. I mean, you know, can't build something futuristic without a monorail. And that's what you have instead of cars. That and another mode of transportation, which has been identified by the engineers as a very good way of getting around in short distances inside a space colony. It may take a while to get this across to the public because they've forgotten about it. We're told that our ancestors, in fact, were able to do this quite well. It's called walking. You see some people engaged in it. And bicycles, too. And you can see that the studies are so detailed that they've even worked out floor plans for places where people would live. The construction of various houses and apartments would be modular in the sense that not that every house would look the same or they all look like Quonset huts or something, but you'd have large-scale things such as walls, door panels, modularized furniture, that sort of thing, and you could put them together in any of a large number of possible varieties, depending on the
depending on your interest and the size of your family and all that kind of thing.
Another cross-section of the thing, here is the housing, there is your monorail, and down underneath the basement, you know, away from everybody, is the things that you have underneath a city, away from everybody. This is a view of the agricultural areas. They are tiered in a very clever way that was worked out in some detail in the summer study, so that the effluent from one level of processing goes down and serves as the fertilizer for the next. And you can get incredible agricultural yield in a totally controlled environment such as this. Oh, something like 10 times as well as you can count on in even the richest farm areas of the earth, Kansas, Iowa, that sort of thing. And that is not pie in the sky dreaming. It is something that has been done on pilot scales in places like the Israeli desert, where it's almost as impossible to grow things as it would be in airless space. And so they have built closed, controlled ecosystems, and it's just phenomenal the sorts of yield that they routinely get. There's your monorail up there, and in the distance there is one of the living and working sections.